the end of the rainbow there's happiness, and to find it how often I've tried. But my life is a race, just a wild goose chase. My dreams have all been denied. Why have I always been a failure? What can the reason be? I wonder if the world's to blame. I wonder if it could be. Just like all my dreams ending in the sky. Some fellas look and find the sunshine. I always look and find the rain. Some fellas make a winning sometime. I never even make a game, believe me. I'm always chasing rainbows, waiting to find a little bluebird.
Debbie Reynolds has written a surprisingly candid account of her life in a new autobiography from William Morrow. Everything you'd expect is here: her accidental movie career, the disastrous marriages to Eddie Fisher and Harry Caul, all the famous people she met along the way, even the notorious Jack Parr incident. But there are also lots of things I hadn't expected to find in a book like this, and we'll try to touch upon a little bit of everything during this hour with Debbie Reynolds on New York & Company. Hello, how are you?
Good morning. Good afternoon.
In Los Angeles. No, it's even...
Well, it's just morning there. Mm-hmm. It's afternoon here.
Biographies by movie stars tend to fall into two categories: the string of anecdotes book that ruffles few feathers, and the let it all hang out, name the names kind. This is a little bit of both. Did you have that in mind when you set out to write it?
Well, my life has involved meeting a lot of movie stars, and so, of course, it's kind of interesting. I know if it were... I buy autobiographies, and I'm always interested in everybody's life. And so I felt when I was writing this book, naturally my life has been now 40 years in show business, that there would be stars' names in it, being that I did meet Judy Garland and Joan Crawford and Betty Hutton and Gene Kelly. You know, these people became friends of mine, so naturally they're in the book, and that's provocative, I guess, for people reading it, because they know people that I knew, you know, and so people relate to that. Then as far as any scandal that entered my life, most of it, the fans or the people through the years know of that sort of point of my book.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some things that I don't think anybody knew until you wrote about them in this book. There were some attitudes, and perhaps, that they suspected.
Well, hopefully they don't know everything, or I didn't need to write the book.
True.
Then it would have already been known. There's a lot of, I felt... the truth being a little more revealing, I absolutely go into what I know to be the truth. So I wanted to write this book because I feel that I have survived a lot, and I am a woman, and I have gone through a lot that women go through, and that is the marriages that fail and the children that you lose and bankruptcy, or the problems that women face when their husbands do leave them bankrupt. And how do you survive these things? And in the book, I try to sort of tell people how to get through it, especially mm-hmm. women.
In a way, you are better prepared for dealing with the bottom because you started off at the bottom.
That's very helpful, because when you've been poor and then you have to lose the funds that you have in life, well, you've been poor, so it's not so shocking. I would hate that my children would have to experience that, because they've always had a lot of money and had everything taken care of, and I don't know if they could survive that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were a survivor in a lot of ways. You had no desire to be a movie star. You wanted to be a phys ed teacher, and
that's right.
And you fought from the beginning. You didn't want to have them change your name from Mary Frances to Debbie. You didn't want to have your nose job. You didn't want to have all the things that they were telling you you needed to become a big star.
It's so silly. They in the old days,
you have a
they
nice
just,
nose.
They
what?
Wanted to change you. Right. I have a very small nose, and I'm Irish, and I'm, you know. I just think I'm Aries. I was born April 1st, that my nature is to be a fighter, and I really don't like being told what to do anyway. And I think especially when I know it's absolutely wrong. My name is Reynolds, and they wanted to change it to Morgan. My real first name is Mary Frances, and they did change it to Debbie, which worked out fine.
Mm-hmm. Now, does anybody call you Mary Frances or Franny?
My mother and my brother.
But everything else was a compromise. You did some and you didn't do
others.
Well,
Jack Warner, who was the head of Warner Brothers Studio, wanted to change my name to Debbie Morgan because Dennis Morgan was a big star and he didn't like Mary Frances. He said, Mary's too plain. Frances is boring. Mary Frances is totally boring. I always liked the name of Frances Reynolds, mm-hmm. because I could have grown up with the name of Frances Reynolds, whereas Debbie is a cute name, but it's cute. And as you get older, it's a hard name to grow up with. You know, it just doesn't grow up because it stays ingenue. So people still think of me as being very young, even though they know I'm not. Mm-hmm. They think of me as ingenue, you know, Debbie, Tammy, cute.
That must be a problem in meeting people. I'm sure that Doris Day is upset that people still see her as that aging virgin she played in so many movies with Rock Hudson. And you as America's sweetheart, the kid everybody loved.
Well, I think it happened to Janie Powell, Doris Day, Debbie Reynolds, Donna Reed, and possibly June Allison.
But in your case, perhaps even more, because you were the last of the string. You were the one who did it with a vengeance, and for a while were the most popular of the batch.
Yeah, right. I think in the films, because that was I made 47 films, and I started when I was 16, and then my career ended in movies with the unsinkable Molly Brown. Actually, my last film was called What's the Matter with Helen, which was a dramatic picture with Shelley Winters that I co-produced. But then when my life, my second husband went, you know, just belly up and broke everybody, why, I had to go into theater and into nightclubs and not stay in Hollywood. So in a way, why my career ended in films was because I hit the road, so to speak, as Willie Nelson would say, and I haven't been back since. So my career, I didn't pursue it from films. You know, I didn't try to pursue it like Piper Laurie or to make the switch of going into older roles. I just am happy on the stage, and I don't have to wait for an agent to call me. I'm not out of work. I'm in the theater.
Mm-hmm. But it does seem a surprise when you look back at your career that you're now spending full time on the stage, because most people who wind up on the stage after a movie career are the ones who started in theater, always wanted to return. Mm-hmm. You, on the other hand, as I said, wanted to be a phys ed teacher, didn't take it too seriously, or as seriously perhaps as the studios would have liked. And it wasn't until Singing in the Rain made you into a superstar that you became a full-time actress and didn't look back.
Well, when I saw Singing in the Rain, I said, gee, that girl is good, and there's something there, and maybe I do have a chance of being successful in films. Before that, I thought I wasn't that trained. I didn't think I was that talented, and I didn't really realize the talent that was underneath in this young little girl. And Gene Kelly and MGM brought that out and gave me a lot of breaks and chances, and I was very lucky, because when you're young and you're not trained, you have that chance that Metro gave me where they pay you a salary and train you. I mean, that's a dream come true.
Well, they trained you, but you didn't always learn what you were supposed to learn, and in fact resisted again and again. It wasn't until you were forced on Gene Kelly in Singing in the Rain that you discovered you're really going to have to learn something. I'm sure a lot of readers will be surprised to discover just how miserable the filming of Singing in the Rain was for you. And that was, did you have any sense when you were doing it that it was worth the sacrifice?
Well, I didn't realize it was going to be a classic film. You know, I knew that this was an enormous amount of work, and it was very difficult work because when you have to dance, you know, 12, 14 hours a day, in those days you worked every Saturday, so you had Sunday just to collapse. There weren't the strong union rules, and I was 18, so that they could work me any hours they wanted to. And Gene Kelly, who was brilliant, and he's a really nice person, but he is a taskmaster. He taught me very well because, after all, he taught me how to work so hard that I'm still working. And I think that when you learn under a perfectionist like Gene, you stay like that, you know, because I am someone that cares a great deal about how I work, and I want everything to be done really well. I don't believe you should just sloppily do anything. I think you really have to care about everything if you want to be successful, and I do want to be successful. I want to do a good job for as long as I work. I don't want to do it half, you know what, as they say.
Mm-hmm. But when you started on Singing in the Rain, you had had a hit record already, Abba Dabba Honeymoon, but you really didn't think of yourself as a singer, and you didn't know one tap from the other, and now you were entering a film in which you had to sing, and you had to dance with the likes of Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean,
And I've looked at the film. You do it very well.
I know. That's what I saw. I couldn't believe that. You know, I knew I worked like an animal, and I really wanted to please Gene, and he was pushing all the time, and I was trying to strive to meet his standards, and I knew I had to because I would have failed them then. I would have failed the film. And I think when I saw that film, I realized that I could keep up with them, and I was very proud of what I had done. So then I started taking everything more seriously. I took that very seriously, but it wasn't a pleasure. It was very hard, and I didn't think I wanted to ever do it or continue it. But then I really thought that I did a good job, and so I asked the studio to get me a tap teacher, and they did. And I continued studying after that 14 years and always studied dancing and singing thereafter in every form and became much better at it.
Well, you had a crash course before the film, 3 months of 10 hours a day of learning.
Yeah, 3 months. And 3 teachers.
And now do you think of yourself as a dancer, as a competent dancer?
Oh, yes. There was a time when I was really wonderful. Now at 56, I mean, after all, about 6 years ago, I said, I don't want to work this hard anymore. So now I tap dance, but I don't do any of the big kicks and the turns and the leaps in the air because it's too tiring for me now. I don't really want to do that. But I don't think you ever want to not tap dance. I mean, tap dancing is really fun and it's very good for you. It's my aerobic, and so I enjoy that. And it's fun. Tap dancing is actually fun.
My guest is Debbie Reynolds, who's written My Life. It's written with the help of David Patrick Columbia, and it's published by William Morrow. If you had come along today, none of this would have happened. There is no studio system. They wouldn't have taught you how to dance.
No, they
would have hired somebody who knew how to dance.
Yes, that's right. No, today there would be no Debbie Reynolds. There would be no Janie Powell. There would be no June Allison. There wouldn't be an Esther Williams, because in the old days they wrote films specifically for that young talent. And if it was Debbie or Esther, especially when you were a swimmer or someone that specialized, certainly you wouldn't happen today, ever.
Since you, in the early years anyway, you always played the innocent girl, the exuberant kid sister. Do you think that left a mark on you, that you, to some degree, that when you work in Hollywood and you get typecast, that you become the character that you play, kind of like a John Wayne actually becoming the Duke?
Well, I think we are that in the beginning. Perhaps other people were pushed into being a personality, but I truly was this naive little virginal girl. I was raised like that. We were a very religious family, and that's what I was. I was the girl next door. And so it really wasn't a fake with me, and luckily they didn't try to push me into, after all, being a sex symbol. I hardly looked like that. I wasn't that. And so they let me be just what I was, and they wrote the parts for the little girl next door and the lighthearted, amusing, funny little girl that I was. And then allowed me to mature, like with the Tender Trap. I was still a young little virginal girl, but like Frank Sinatra was attracted to me. So then we got married, and, you know, and we did light films like that. And those went on to be like that with Tammy and Goodbye Charlie, which was a departure for me with Tony Curtis and Walter Matthau. I was growing up then, and I was allowed to grow up in How the West Was Won, which was a film that took a year to make that I write about some stories in that with
about
the director.
Henry Hathaway, the great director of How the West Was Won.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you are they really don't have a clue because they put you in this very great film, Singing in the Rain, and then they allow you. Then they don't cash in on that. Some of the films are better. Some of the films are worse. But
which is not in the book, is that L.B. Mayer, who was Mr. Mayer of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. They threw him out at that point, right after Singing in the Rain. You see, he had bought Jumbo for me to do and Peg of My Heart, which he was having written. And if he had stayed at MGM, my career would have been larger or better, perhaps, in the sense of better roles, mm-hmm. you know, and not so just cutesy roles. I mean, they would have been more substance. He would have groomed me on and carried me further. But, you know, they threw him out at that point, and Dorie Sherry came in, who wanted to do message pictures and more dramatic pictures, and did. And a lot of us were out of work for maybe 10 years, and he dropped big stars, Lana Turner, Greer Garson.
Clark Gable.
He dropped them like hot potato, and just, it was a very cutthroat time, and that was a bad time. And they kept me because I was under contract so cheap that they just throw me in these films, and they really took advantage of me at that point. And when I married Eddie Fisher, then that romance made my name even hotter for them, so they just threw me into almost any kind of a lighthearted film that turned out to be charming and the public liked them, but they weren't any demands on me as an actress, and they didn't develop me as an actress, no. But, I mean, I liked them. They were cute films.
Was the whole school system, all of the rest of the stuff that MGM had, eliminated when Dorie Sherry took over?
Well, mostly, yes. I would say yes. The singing all dropped and stopped. For me, he kept certain teachers on because I was important to them, and they felt that they could really work me because of my salary and
how much
my
were you
youth.
Making in those days? How much did you make for
$700 a week. Singing in the Rain, I made $300 a week.
$300 a week, wow.
$300 a week, and it took 6 months to make, so you can add that up. And, of course, none of us get a piece of that at any time that it's ever run and never have. And so that's sort of not fair for any films, especially Gene Kelly. Imagine who created it. But he didn't own it. You see, Gene Kelly also was under contract. And
so the studio system had its good and bad side. The good side is that they could develop somebody like you. The bad side is that they took advantage of somebody like you.
They made millions off of all of us, right.
And then while they were paying you $300 a week, they could shop you off to another studio, get paid $1,000 or $2,000 a week and still just pay you $300.
Well, hundreds of thousands. I mean, they loaned me out for a picture called The Rat Race, and they made $175,000. For Tammy, $150,000. For Susan Slept Here, they made $225,000. So right there, they had already paid my salary for my lifetime.
Yeah, you have to wonder about public resentment salaries that are paid today. Or do you think that it's gone too far? Do you think that...
I think it's really gone far.
Marlon Brando asked for $5 million to appear in a film these days.
Well, they don't have to pay him, do they? So they do. So they must feel that he's worth it. I think that's a lot of money. I'd love to see some of the stars turn around and put that into charity in a major way because no stars in our day made that kind of money, yet we all seem to do well enough. I think it's gotten out of proportion myself.
And in those days, you had all sorts of other responsibilities. You had to do weekly photo sessions. You had to cope with very powerful gossip columnists. You actually had to keep Luella and Hedda happy. I don't know. Was it a happy time, do you think?
Well, it was for me. But, see, I didn't take the problem of Luella and Hedda. They liked me. Hedda got mad at me for a certain time because Hedda had married an older man. And when I married Harry Carl, she was furious because she said he was too old for me and I'd wind up unhappily married like she. Little did I know she was right. But I got very angry with her and she said, well, why don't you marry Glenn Ford? You take such a good picture together. I said, Hedda, that's not why you get married, because you're cute together. But they tried to dictate your life, of course. I mean, I never allowed that. I've always tried to do what I felt was right to do, whether I was wrong, because obviously I have very poor taste in men, and my life has proven that, and I realize that I don't have good taste, or the ability to judge is probably a better way to word it.
We'll get to that in a moment. One more thing about the studio times, and also during your marriage to Eddie Fisher. You talk a lot about the doctors with the vitamin shots. That seems to be almost endemic to show business at that time. Those were people who were injecting amphetamines into
Time, it seems that, which I was not aware of, and none of us, I guess, really were aware of, the fact that the studios wouldn't want you to get tired and wouldn't want you to miss a day's work. So if you did, they would give you, you thought, what was a vitamin shot. And there was always a doctor and a nurse on the lot that were hired regularly, and they were paid by the studios. So that's how a few of the stars, like Judy Garland and Marie McDonald, who later came back into my life, became addicted to speed and amphetamine. And that was a problem. I hated shots all my whole life. So I don't like needles, you know. I'm chicken, I guess. And I just never did it on... thank God. And my mother and my family doctor told me that that was very bad and dangerous for me. So I was really lucky that my mother was not a stage mother, a movie mother, and my health was much more important to her than whether the studio was happy or not. She couldn't have cared less. So being that we were such an average family, we were not really impressed, and especially my mother and dad, about my being in films. They always thought it was a joke anyway.
You were going to go to hell when you first got into the films.
Yes, the movies to them was really not where they wanted me to be. My daddy always kept saying, when are you going to get a real job? When are you going to get a proper job? They never really liked it.
But you were doing 5 movies in 15 months. Mm-hmm. That has to be some job. Is that a tiring experience?
Well, you go to work, you know, early, like every average job, except you work longer hours, not than some jobs, but it is tedious, and it was hard work, and you worked from 5 in the morning until, you know, sometimes 8, 9, 10 at night, depends. But if it's a musical, of course, it's totally exhausting. And if you're young, you're really not used to that kind of discipline, and you can't ever seem to breathe fresh air. You work in a soundstage all day. You never see the sun, and you feel sort of like a cocoon, you know, that you're just in this black stage working all day, and it's not a normal life for a child at all. So I'm happy I went into it only at 16 and wasn't like a child star. I wouldn't have liked that.
You reveal that during the time that you were working much too hard to learn how to tap dance, you almost gave up, and then Fred Astaire encouraged you to continue. Jane Powell told me on the show that Fred Astaire was one of the colder people she worked with. What do you think it was about your situation that made him warm up to you?
Well, I wasn't in the movie with him, number one. So I wasn't his leading lady, so he didn't have to be mad at me. Mm-hmm. And he saw a little girl who was lost and crying underneath the piano, and I'm sure the father in him or the teacher in him said, I will give her a word of encouragement. He didn't have me on his back every day like Gene Kelly was my master, so to speak, and I'm sure Fred was as tough on Janie as Gene was on me. It was a different situation than Janie would have had with Fred. I mean, I'm sure that Fred was very exacting with her, as Gene was with me.
Although Gene Kelly always yelled at Donald O'Connor so that he wouldn't yell at you all the time.
Well, in the beginning, he yelled at me a lot until I would cry so much. So when, you know, I kept losing my eyelashes and my makeup would run, and he realized that if he kept yelling at me, it was going to delay shooting. So he would yell at Donald, and then I would get upset, but I wouldn't cry. And only years later, last year, Donald and I did an act together, and Donald said, do you realize why he yelled at me, Debbie? I said, I don't know why he yelled at you, Donald. You weren't doing anything wrong. He said, no, but you were. So he didn't want to yell at you because you would cry again, so he yelled at me.
Debbie Reynolds has written Debbie, My Life with David Patrick Columbia. It's published by William Morrow and Company. And we'll find out all about the marriages and we'll invite your calls right after this.
Ah, the world must be bigger than an avenue, Ninth Avenue, I know. Sure, the life is grand with family and friends, but let's face it, girl, this isn't where it ends. There's a place in the land of opportunity, and it's calling me to go. So no matter what may happen, I'm giving it a try. I'm not gonna sit here napping until the day I die. Oh, the world must be bigger than an avenue, Ninth Avenue. Goodbye. Oh, I'll find me a corner in that world somewhere, Miss Irene O'Dare, that's me. You can tell the folks around this neighborhood, here's one local girl that's bent on making good. Just you show me a hero who's got fancy charms in his waiting arms, I'll be. I have love to fill an ocean and stardust in my eye, so I'll set my feet in motion as fast as they can fly. Oh, the world must be bigger than an avenue, Ninth Avenue. Goodbye. Just show me a hero.
This is New York and Company on AM 83 WNYC. I'm Leonard Lopate. And my guest is the person who's singing right now, Debbie Reynolds. She's written her autobiography with David Patrick Columbia. It's called Debbie, My Life, and it's published by William Morrow and Company. And what we were just listening to was the original cast performance of Irene, which you starred in on Broadway, and which got your daughter started in show business. You brought her to the Broadway stage in the chorus line.
Carrie and I, well, my marriage had ended, you know, I mean, I had to leave my husband and...
That was Harry Carl.
Harry Carl, and this was 1972, and so I was very fortunate to have been offered this play. It was sort of my savior in a way, and I came to New York, and I couldn't bring Todd, who was still in school, and Carrie was too, but I could get her extension courses, so she went in the chorus. She was only 15, and Todd stayed at home with Harry Carl and finished school in Beverly Hills. And Carrie started, you know, learning how to dance and sing in the chorus and take her extension courses, but they soon fizzled out because I think, you know, you can't hold down two jobs. You can't be in a play and be up all night and study. And I said, well, you're probably going to be in show business anyway, so we're just not going to worry about that.
Did it bother you that she started her movie career at 18 or 19 in Shampoo in a sexier role than you ever had in all of your movie career?
Actually, she was 17, and I opposed Shampoo because she had to say a very vivid cuss word, and I said to Warren Beatty, I don't really, why can't you rewrite this and say something else? And he said, Debbie, don't be stupid. The shock of the word is... But so she wanted to do this, and she said, Mother, our generation is much more vivid than yours, so you can't hold me back. So I let her do the picture. That was 17. And then she did, after that, Star Wars, which, of course, made her whole career.
And yet she seems to have withdrawn to some degree from filmmaking. Now she has made a mark as a writer, in fact, a very well-reviewed novelist.
I think it's wonderful. She always wrote, you know, in poetry and all pages of papers all the time. Wonderful, brilliant things when she was young. But now she did Postcards from the Edge, which is a wonderful book for young people to read because it's about obsession and involves drugs and a lot of... It's very funny and cryptic and crazy. It's not exactly what my mother would understand. I even found it a little shocking verbally. Mm-hmm. But she received the Penn Award for it, and it's been a wonderful success, so I'm very proud of that for her.
Even though, to some degree, that involves washing dirty linen in public?
Well, I didn't feel she did in the book. First of all, it's a novel. A lot of that was her experience in a drug rehabilitation clinic, but it was all about different kind of people that she met in that clinic, and then she put it in her own imagination and created this novel. I thought she did a brilliant job with it. So she wasn't really writing exactly about her experiences, but naturally every writer, even I as an actress, apply what I know or I've been what I've gone through or what I'm going through to a role. Don't we all do that? We take our own experiences of life and then put them into that character or that book we're writing. So I don't think that's wrong at all.
When did you realize that you were in this, that you were going to be an actress for the rest of your life and you'd better take it seriously? How many films?
Well, I would say, how many films? Gosh, I don't know. 20-some films, I suppose.
No, but how many films had you made before you realized that?
20-some.
Oh, that many.
I was 28, and I was asked to do a picture called Mary Mary at Warner Brothers. Now, it was already a successful Broadway play, and Barry Nelson and Barbara Bel Geddes did it, and she received the Tony, I believe, for it, or Barry, too. And I saw them in the play. They were brilliant. And when I was asked to do it, I said, why don't you use Barbara Bel Geddes? She's brilliant. Well, Debbie, because you're the movie star name. And at that time, my name was very hot. And I went into rehearsal to do this movie, and I realized I really wasn't up to Barry Nelson and the role that I saw Barbara Bel Geddes do. So I called a coach who had been my coach when I was 17 and 18 and wanted me to study harder. And I was so cute, I thought, oh, well, I'm funny enough without studying. I realized then that I did not have the technique I needed, so at 28, I began seriously studying acting and have continued ever since to this day on my dramatic acting for my comedy, and now I feel that I'm a very good actress, and I should be because I've worked all those years.
A lot of directors resented having to work with you because of that attitude, perhaps on your part or because that was the image of Debbie Reynolds. You had one well-known dramatic director, Richard Brooks, calling you Debbie Darling, Debbie Dimples, and Miss Hollywood at different times.
Yes.
Did that hurt, or did you just think, well, what the heck, they're even right in some ways. I don't care.
No, I did care deeply. I didn't feel he was right about that, but he didn't want me in that film. But you see, again, it was the Hollywood system, and he had his bosses, too, in those days, so he was stuck with me. Now, he had Bette Davis, Ernie Borgnine, Barry Fitzgerald, a brilliant cast, and he wanted a New York actress or a dramatic actress that was known to be dramatic, not Miss Cute Debbie. And so he was prejudiced, really, and I did a very nice acting job for him, and he's a wonderful director, but he was also very cruel to me with his statements, and I'm sure he's since forgotten, but I didn't because they hurt me deeply, that he would call me those things simply because I was Debbie Reynolds and I had married Eddie Fisher, so he thought that I was just a Hollywood flibbertigibbet, and it was wrong of him to judge me.
Mm-hmm. A part of that studio system also involved being out in public a lot. One of your first dates was with Rock Hudson, a public date.
Well, no, actually, Rock and I never dated because he was a very good friend, but he didn't really date, you know. Tab Hunter I dated and Bob Wagner. And
Bob Wagner you took seriously.
Craig Hill was another boy. Gosh, Hugh O'Brien, you know, because they were all under contract and we were under contract, so we all met. We were like young Hollywood, you know.
Well, what were those dates like, since they were probably more for publicity than for any
just
real socializing?
Fun. Just fun, like boy meets girl. Never anything, you know, no kissing, no touching. It was just a hi, and you were pals, and you went out, and they took your picture, and you had a great time, and everybody was just, it was like a club, you know, like a little university.
It's odd to read this in the light of all of those books we've had, in which talked about the casting couch in Hollywood and the way, the power politics that went on. Why do you think you escaped all of that? Why do you think people didn't constantly pressure you?
Well, I think that I was exactly what I was. So I was jailbait at one point. You know, I was too young, I think, for them to try to approach. And then I definitely was not available. I definitely, it would have been a problem for them. I would have screamed and yelled and punched. And so I don't think that they wanted to bother trying to get fresh with me. I didn't have the problem that I understand Shirley Temple has written about in her book, which I find just shocking and tasteless, and I just can't imagine it. But my best girlfriend at the time, one of my best girlfriends, who was very sexy looking, she had dark hair and big boobs and all that, was chased around. And I mean, I just couldn't believe that. That some man would do that. Why in the world would somebody do that? I just thought it was horrendous and shocking. And I probably would have just, I don't think I would have fainted, but I certainly would have fought. And I think they knew that, perhaps.
Elizabeth Taylor was your classmate at that time. I don't know whether she's a dark-haired beauty with the big boobs, but
I would say.
She was chased around because she looked older than you, because she was less.
Well, she was more sexual than I. I think that men somehow were turned on by women that were really quite magnificent and beautiful and gorgeous. I mean, that was a huge conquest to them. I was always the cutesy little thing, and I think that they thought of me more as maybe their daughter, their sister, and I didn't have that big problem. I know many girls that did.
Let's invite listeners to join in our conversation. Our number is 212-267-WNYC. My guest is Debbie Reynolds, whose life story is told in a new book from William Morrow and Company called Debbie, My Life. And she wrote it with the help of David Patrick Columbia. I guess the time has come to talk about the loves of your life. Robert Wagner was the first serious love, and you still have a lot of affection for him, if I read this book correctly.
Well, I think it was a real crush. You know, after all, when you're young, and my goodness, I can't. Most women say, oh, isn't Robert Wagner the most handsome, gorgeous thing? And he still is. And naturally, and we dated for a year and a half, 2 years. So I just thought he was the most wonderful boy ever. And in my age, you know, I was 17, I adored him.
Mm-hmm. But you still exhibit a certain amount of affection for him, at least in this book. And I wonder why, when the both of you were free later in life,
were free at the same time.
It was just bad timing.
Well, we'd like to look at it that way, won't we?
In a way, your marriage to Eddie Fisher was almost a rebound situation. You broke up with R.J., Robert Wagner, and then Eddie Fisher came along, pursued you hotly, and asked you to marry him fairly soon after you started dating.
Yes, I was very taken by that, and Eddie did pursue me, and he was adorable and cute, and I thought, my goodness, you know, R.J., on the other hand, Bob Wagner was the one to leave the relationship, and he wanted more than I could give him. And certainly he didn't want to be married, whereas Eddie wanted to be married. And you see, I was not the kind in those days that you didn't sleep around and you didn't do those things. So for me, Eddie offered me marriage. He offered me a true commitment, whereas certainly Bob Wagner wasn't asking for that.
But he can't be happy with what you say about him in this book. You describe him as needy. At one time, you describe him as an elevator that can't find the floor.
That's about
right.
Was he
that lost?
Was he or is he?
Well, is he worse now?
Well, I don't see him now, but yes, he has his own set of problems, and fortunately, I don't have to deal with them. But in the book, I tell the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, he can't be happy because part of his image is of a great lover. In fact, I think he wrote his own.
You think his image is a great lover?
Well, he wrote it. Didn't he reveal somewhere along the line that he named a long string of some of the great Hollywood beauties who he had had affairs with?
I never heard that. Maybe if he
even
said
even Marlene Dietrich, I think, was one of the names that came up. Forgive me if I'm wrong, Marlene.
Gosh, poor Marlene. Do you know how many people poor Marlene is supposed to have been with? I'm sure Marlene would say, I don't think so, dear. I think it's all quite an imaginary wish for all the men would like to be with me. But it doesn't mean really that I were.
Let's take some calls, and we'll continue talking about Eddie and talk about Harry Carl and how you recovered from that terrible experience of marrying a multimillionaire and finding yourself bankrupt. Our number is 212-267-WNYC. Our guest is Debbie Reynolds, and Anita is calling from Flushing. Hi, Anita, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you. How long were you married to Harry Carl? And the second question, are you close to your daughter and your son?
I was married to Harry 13 years, and then we dated a year before that, you know, went together. And yes, I'm very close to my daughter, Carrie, and I'm seeing her in New York here, and we talk all the time, and, you know, she's wonderful, and I'm very grateful that we are close together.
Uh-huh. And your son?
My son Todd is just wonderful, and he's a divine young man, and he lives in Los Angeles, and he's a very religious boy, and he works putting in sound installations, and he wants to be a director someday, but he's still working towards that.
Very interesting, Debbie. I'm listening to your program. It's very interesting.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for calling us. Both marriages lasted longer than some people would have thought they should have. And in both cases, it was Eddie Fisher and Harry Carl who ultimately left or let you down. Are you the marrying kind?
Well, yes, that I am. And I just don't believe in failure. You know, I never like to give up. I always think it'll work out. There'll be some way. God will see us through and it'll be okay. I keep dreaming in my mind, even when I know it's over, that there's got to be a way, because I don't believe you get married for it to end. I mean, you don't fall in love for thinking that you're going to ever have a problem of falling out of love or that the marriage will be over. That's not why you enter it. So one of the reasons is that I'm just stubborn enough to think that I can work it out.
Let's go to another call. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
This afternoon. This is a real great pleasure and honor to speak to, I don't like to put people on a pedestal, but you don't usually get this kind of opportunity to talk to somebody who you watched on television. And
well, thank you.
I'd like to know.
Are you going to hum a few bars of Tammy now to show us that you really are a fan?
Well, I'm really a lot younger than.
I can tell by your voice, yeah. You are right.
But it's just really, you know, I just like this kind of thing anyway. But I want to ask you a question about. You mentioned earlier about the kind of prices that. New movie actors and actresses get in films, you know, major stars. And what kind of price would you ask if you were to be major, you know, offered a major role? Or, you know, what would you be looking for, or do you even consider to go back into film?
Well, I'd probably pay them.
But you'd want to be paid more than $300 a week.
Oh yes, they get today. Usually, I'd be playing now an older role or a mother role or.
You don't look so bad. So hey, I've seen a recent picture of you. You don't look so bad.
You're very sweet. I don't know what people would get today for supporting roles. I imagine they would get $100,000, $200,000, somewhere in that vicinity, for a supporting role, which is what I would be playing now at this time of my life. A leading role, I don't think that I would be offered.
But $100,000 would be more than you made in 10 pictures in the old days.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you for calling us.
Bye, dear.
Whenever I read a book of this sort, I always think of the picture painted of the father in connection with the husbands. And I wonder whether you've seen any connections here. Your father was a rather reserved man, so proud or macho that he refused to use the earnings that you were making in your film career to help out the family during a time when things were really tight. And then you married two guys who, to all intents and purposes, would be a lot warmer than your father. In both cases, they turned out to not be all that much warmer.
It's an interesting situation, I think, for all of us to go through in life. You maybe have experienced it also, that when love is young, there seems to be a lot of tenderness and touching and intimacy, and then when the man or the woman, I suppose, falls out of love, then that ends. And that's very sad for anyone to go through, and that does happen, and that did happen to me in both marriages, where the husbands became very cold and distant, and that is a very sad thing when that happens to a marriage. I don't know how you get it back. I didn't seem to make that work in my marriages. I realized that I was young and that I didn't know very much. But even
could you
when
have been responsible in any way, making them cold?
I don't know. I don't want to accept that, because I do feel that after certainly my second marriage, I felt that I knew a little bit more, but obviously I didn't know enough. So I guess life goes on, and I don't accept full blame for failure in both marriages. I think that you try. And when your husband really leaves you, then he's gone. When the second husband leaves you and you find out that there have been many other women, it is always a very upsetting situation when you have been totally faithful. And I just find that is something for, it's very hard to get over that.
In the case of Eddie Fisher, you were marrying him at a time when his career had to go into decline. He was a big star, but rock and roll was coming along, and after a short while, Elvis and Buddy Holly and all of that were on the charts. Only Tammy, in fact, your record, could compete with those guys. Eddie Fisher's was no longer turning out.
Well, I think Tammy was a real fluke and a freak sort of thing. I mean, it was wonderful and it was great. But I don't think Eddie could have ever helped Elvis. I mean, the fact that you had all these changes come in. Vic Damone was singing. A lot of other stars went, their careers went to the back because of Elvis and rock and roll took over. There was nothing Eddie could have done about that. Eddie always had a glorious voice and still does, so God gave him that. You never lose that, but you do lose momentum.
But perhaps the fact that you were still, your career was still on the ascendancy and his was about to fall apart.
Well, he
may
didn't
have
know
created
that.
Tension.
Yeah, no one knew that. That was sad that was coming up, but that did come up. That did happen.
Yeah, but in both cases, the bottom fell out somewhere in the marriage. During Harry Carl, well, Harry Carl strikes me as a fascinating character for, among other reasons, having a haircut every day. There aren't too many people.
A hair comb.
He had a barber come in and comb his hair, especially.
Every day, comb his hair and shave him. That's rich.
Gee, I like combing my own hair. I think I know how it looks best.
He didn't. He was spoiled, and he liked it, and I'm sure Onassis and other people lived like that, too. I mean, certainly I didn't live like that, but that was one of his eccentricities, and he loved it. He enjoyed it.
Was his being a millionaire a comforting thought for you when you married him?
Oh, absolutely. I wanted a man that would give me security and love my children and take care of me and look after me, because from my first marriage ending, I was very insecure. And I wanted a real father image. That's what I wanted. I did not want a high sexual romance of any kind. I wanted to be safe and secure, and not just financially. I mean, you know, really feeling comfortable, and I was. And we had a very good 7 years in the marriage. The marriage went 13 years, and a lot of those years were not good. But there were 7 marvelous years, and had he not really fallen to pieces on me, why, we would have still been married.
Well, you were warned that he had a gambling habit. That didn't really become a big problem.
I don't know how you lose $21 million. I mean, to me, gambling would be as if you lost, you know, $1,000, $5,000. That's like a big deal to me. I wasn't aware that you really could lose hundreds of thousands of dollars in one night. I mean, that is just, that's beyond my thinking.
You reveal that in the book that you were molested at the age of 6 by a neighborhood boy. Do you think that caused some of the problems in your marriage?
In my marriage? No.
Well, in the way that you related to men, because people are often seriously affected by that kind of experience.
No, I don't think I was affected in a sexual manner in that way, because I was frightened about having my first experience or being with a man for the first time. But once I was with a man and realized this was all very natural and all very nice, then no, I didn't have any hang-up about that.
Let's take another call.
All right.
And Leah. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Leo.
Yes, Leo. Hi.
Okay.
How are you doing?
Hi, Leo.
Good. I'm really glad to hear you, too, by the way. You do sound absolutely it is wonderful to talk to a historic figure.
Well, thanks, Leo.
I didn't mean it that way.
Yeah, no. Don't talk to her as though she's a fossil, you know.
No, she didn't mean that.
No, but it is wonderful hearing, after following your career and seeing how you've matured, you know, because I say that as a sort of a card-carrying progressive liberal, too, you know, who doesn't take to the old itsy, you know, Hollywood stars and everything.
Right.
And I was wondering, because you sound, and I've seen pictures of you too, and you look great to me, and I'm sure your acting has increased over the years, why do you think you would only be offered a supporting role? Because, like, Shirley MacLaine is now doing this role. I mean, I would see you as being, you know, prime for one of those. Yeah,
well, you have to be offered the role, and mostly, yes, Shirley would be offered the role, or Anne Bancroft or Lee Remick before Debbie. I don't know. They just, you know, don't think of you because, number one, I'm gone all the time. I'm on the road all the time, and the other people are a little more visible, and I just don't know the reason.
Well, there's some marketing problem here because your name is still wonderful to millions and millions.
But perhaps she is a victim of her image. Her image is still light comedy. Musicals, things of that sort.
But I still like playing those roles, too. You know, I do like comedy best of all.
Well, yeah, like I said, MacLaine did break with that, though, here in this current film, and very successfully. So
Well, yes, she's made the break. She's made the transition. And I hope to be like Ruth Gordon, and that's what I'd like to do. I mean, I think that's wonderful.
We hope so, too.
Thank you, honey.
Thank you for calling. Meanwhile, you also make videos, exercise videos. Has that, not for Carl video, are they?
No,
Jane
no.
Fonda's a for Carl video, and I thought that would be one of the great ironies if you made videos for Carl.
No, actually, it was by a video associate company that went bankruptcy. Right now, it's VidAmerica bought out my first exercise tape 5 years ago was Do It Debbie's Way for women beginners that were over age 40, and now I did a couples tape for men and women over 40s, married or otherwise. And so the tapes have done really, really well. It's been interesting to me to think that you can make that kind of money on doing an exercise video. I exercise to my tape because I like it. It's easy and I can keep up with it. And I have done well with it financially. So that has been really a surprise for me.
Is there a happy ending? Do you learn from all of these experiences now? Are you financially secure? Are you in love? Do you know what to look for when you choose a man?
Well, oh goodness, I think I have no taste in judging men at all. My last husband, my favorite husband, he's my third husband, he says he's my favorite husband, is a gentleman that picked me out, and hopefully because he picked me out and he wanted to get married, not I, I'm praying that everything will always work out. We're married 4 years now. He lives in Virginia, and I live in Las Vegas and L.A. and travel a great deal, and hopefully, we'll always keep a lot of space and that the marriage will go on and on.
Thank you so much, Debbie Reynolds, for having been on New York & Company.
Thank you. It was fun.
Follow Dominique. In his footsteps I will go. Dominique, Nika, Nika, I will follow Dominique. His burdens will I share. For his courage will I pray. His teachings to obey. His word shall be my prayer.